Okay, so yesterday we finished looking at the spectrum of the superstring. So the first three lectures that we've had are what I would consider the standard core material of string theory. In this final lecture, I want to do something I guess you can think of as a more advanced topic. But this is something that will lead you into some more current developments. So we're going to talk about Riemann-Riemann charges and T-duality. Now, a priori, these two topics don't really seem to have anything to do with each other. I put them together in the same talk because I want to use them as a mechanism to give you systematic evidence for the existence of D-brains in superstring theory. So this is why I've put the two together. So what I'm going to do first is I'm going to go back to what we were doing yesterday and fill in this little gap that I left out. I didn't talk about the Riemann-Riemann sector of the superstring. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back and analyze that carefully, and we'll see that this is going to introduce a notion of what's called Riemann-Riemann charges. Then I'm going to move on and talk about a symmetry of string theory, something which is interesting in its own right. It's called T-duality. And it's a very interesting symmetry because it's a symmetry that's possessed only by strings. It does not have an analog in quantum field theory. It's really due to the extended nature of strings. So we'll start and look at describing T-duality for closed strings. Then we'll go on and look at open strings. And when we look at T-duality for open strings, this is where we'll start to see D-brains coming into the picture. And then I'll finish off by mentioning what T-duality does to superstrings. And this word type 2 will also be explained in this lecture. So we'll start. So let's go and look at the Riemann-Riemann sector of the closed superstring. Now remember, for open strings, we had these two different GSO projection operators. They differed by the choice of sign in front of this 10-dimensional chirality operator. The given sign choice just selects a given spinner of a definite chirality. So gamma 11 has eigenvalues plus or minus 1, and which sign you choose here will select the plus or minus 1 eigenvalue of gamma 11 down there. Now, for open strings, either one of these is a good GSO projection. It's a matter of convention which one you want to choose, which type of chirality spinners you want to use in describing the theory. And both choices turn out to give you physically equivalent results. However, when you look at closed strings and you start gluing the left and right movers together, there is a distinction between which sign you choose. In all, so there are two choices in each sector, so in all there are four possible choices. But we can identify two of them by flipping the sign convention of this operator, minus 1, to the total fermion number. So if necessary, we can identify two of these possible sign choices between the sectors by flipping the sign. So that leaves us with two possible choices. Either we have the same sign in both the left and right sectors, or we have the opposite sign in the left and right sectors. So that gives us we're now thinking of the relative chirality between the spinners in the left and right moving sectors of the superstring. And whether they have the same chirality or the opposite chirality leads us to two different types of string theories. And these string theories are called type 2A and type 2B. So for the type 2A superstring, we take the opposite GSO projection in the two sectors. So they have the opposite GSO projection, so the spinners have opposite chirality in the left and right moving sectors. So in the left movers will have an expansion, and I introduced this basis of of chiral spinners yesterday. So they'll have an expansion in, say, the chiral spinners in the left moving sector, whereas in the right moving sectors, they'll have an expansion in terms of the anti-chiral spinners. In the type 2B case, we take the same GSO projection in both sectors, so the spinners have the same chirality, and they're both expandable in the same basis of chiral spinners. So that's type 2A and type 2B. So let me take a moment now to discuss what this terminology means. So I'm going to tell you what the five consistent superstring theories are, briefly, just in words. So the type 2 superstrings are the things we've been looking at implicitly now, because everything I've been doing has been for strings which have oriented world sheets. They have oriented world sheets, and the theory possesses n equals 2 space-time supersymmetry. So I showed you yesterday that this theory had was supersymmetric with respect to the target space, and it turns out that it has an n equals 2 supersymmetry. Now, from the type 2B string, we can form another type of string called a type 1 string. There are many ways to define it. The way I'm going to tell you is that you can get it from 2B by taking a projection which keeps only the diagonal sum of these gravitino fields that I had yesterday. I had these two types of gravitino fields. You take their sum, keep only the diagonal sum of these two gravitino fields. This breaks the target space supersymmetry from n equals 2 down to n equals 1. And this is now, because of this projection, this is now a theory of unoriented string world sheets. So things like the Möbius strip or the Klein bottle. Okay. And now for the gauge group, the Chan-Peyton gauge group, well, it turns out that quantum consistency, anomaly cancellation, singles out the group SO32 as the only possible one. Finally, there are two types of heterotic strings, which are a heterodesis of two different types of strings. So what you do is for the left moving sector, you take the D equals 26 bosonic string. In the right moving sector, you take the D equals 10 superstring. But now you've got a mismatch between degrees of freedom that you would otherwise require for supersymmetry. You need to get 16 additional degrees of freedom in here. And you get those 16 degrees of freedom as internal degrees of freedom, which come from a rank 16 lattice. And that rank 16 lattice is required by modular invariance to be even and self-dual. There are essentially only two such lattices, it turns out, and those correspond to the weight lattices of the Lie groups E8 cross E8 and SO32. So these are the two types of heterotic strings. And so in the first lecture, I just mentioned what the five consistent superstring theories were in 10 dimensions. Now I've explained to you roughly where the terminology comes from. No, you can have closed strings. I mean,
all the strings are closed strings.
Well, there's an open string sector also. That's what I said. There's the open string Champagne.
All the strings have both open strings.
Yes. Okay, so that was just a side remark. That's not something we really need. It was just to educate you on the terminology. I'm going to stick with type 2 superstrings. So I'm going to look at oriented world sheets.
How many supersymmetry
do you
have for
the supersymmetry. I think it's n equals 1. Okay, let's look at what the states look. Let's look at the spectrum now in the Ramond-Ramond sector, in the type 2 case. So I'll give you an exercise to start you off. These are some gamma matrix identities. You're usually mostly familiar with this when you do quantum field theory. You prove identities like this in 4 dimensions, and now the exercise is just to do this in the 10-dimensional case. So it's just an exercise in Dirac algebra. So I'll prove these identities. The square brackets around the set of indices means to anti-symmetrize. Take all possible combinations of the indices and anti-symmetrize over them. Okay, so there are these four identities which we're going to need. So now we'll use what we've done before. Group theory is a nice tool here to look at what the possible states are. We classify these states according to irreducible representations of the appropriate things that we're combining to form the spectrum of the theory. So what I'm going to do is, at first I'm going to do everything without imposing physical constraints. So I'll classify things and then I'll impose the physical constraints. You could take the other route where you first imposed physical constraints on the sector and then did a similar argument to what I'm doing. You get the same answer in the end, but I find it easier to take this route. Okay, so the Riemann-Riemann sector, what are we doing? We're taking the product of two spinners. Taking the product of two spinners, and before the mass shell constraints, these spinners live in Majorana-Veil representations of the 10-dimensional Lorentz group. Okay, so these representations are denoted 16S and 16C. So in the type 2A case, what do? Well, we've got the opposite chirality in the left and right moving sector. So we should take the product of the spinner 16 with the conjugate spinner 16, the one with the opposite chirality. And it's known from group theory how to decompose this into irreducible representations. It decomposes like this. The bracket with an integer inside denotes the n times anti-symmetrized representation of spin 10. Okay, so it's the n times anti-symmetric representation. So for the type 2A case, you see that it decomposes into even representations. The type 2B case, we take the same chirality in the left and right moving sectors, and the tensor product now looks like this. Again, now it's decomposed into odd numbers. Then the plus here denotes a certain self-duality condition, which I'll come to in a moment. So that's what it looks like group theoretically. What does this look like in terms of fields? So what we'll do is these n times anti-symmetrized representations will correspond to anti-symmetric tensors of rank n. So rank n tensors, which are completely anti-symmetric in their indices, these are called n-forms. And we can write down what those, define those by decomposing a Riemann bispinner, the tensor product of two spinners, in a basis of anti-symmetrized Dirac matrices. Okay. So the equivalent to this group theory decomposition is just taking the two spinners and decomposing them according to these anti-symmetrized Dirac matrices. So in the type 2A case, we take the product of spinners which have opposite chirality, and you can show that that corresponds to summing over only even numbers of products of Dirac matrices. And then we have these n forms sitting here. These are the completely anti-symmetric rank n tensors. Well, you can show it, yeah.
Not just by looking at it.
Well, it agrees with this here. I mean, this is a... where is that? Here. And in the 2B case, you take the product of spinners with the same chirality, and now the sum is over odd numbers of products of Dirac matrices. And these coefficients can be found by just inverting these relations. You can invert them in the following fashion and read off what these coefficients are. Well, now you think about the GSO projection. So the GSO projection tells you that these states should have a definite eigenvalue of the 10-dimensional chirality operator. So if you apply gamma 11 to these, they should have a definite eigenvalue. So you do that. That's an exercise. That uses this exercise up here, the first part of this exercise. You do that. Apply gamma 11 to this side. Use exercise 1A, and then just demand that this have a definite chirality. And what you find after some messy algebra is that you should identify these n forms in the following way. You take the antisymmetric tensor in 10 dimensions, contract 10 minus n of the indices on this form, and that should give you back the original form, up to some constants. Okay? And this is just 10-dimensional Hodge duality. So this, in the group theory picture now, this means that there's an isomorphism between the corresponding representations. The n representation is identified with the 10 minus n representation. And of course, if you put 5, n equals 5 in here, the 5 representation is just automatically itself under this type of duality. So that's what the plus denotes. It denotes the fact that it's self-dual with respect to this type of duality.
In general, the 5 can be sum of self-dual and anti-self-dual, and you have to project it into the self-dual.
Can it be the sum of self-dual and anti-self-dual?
I don't know, because, I mean, I think
self-dual, I mean, self-dual here is, I haven't given you a sign, right? I'm just saying that if you do this contraction, you have an identification, and it's up to some constant. So this is what I mean by self-duality. Okay. So your second exercise now is just to play around with this identification. So convince yourself that it's true, and just convince yourself by arguing that the number of degrees of freedom on both sides of these equations are the same. So you count up how many degrees of freedom there are in the product of these two spinners, these two Majorana-Veil spinners in 10 dimensions, and show that it's the same as the number of degrees of freedom you get by summing over these degrees of freedom, which are antisymmetric rank n tensors. So this is just a simple combinatorical exercise. The second part is really now to write down the equations of motion that's satisfied by these fields. So you take the Dirac-Ramond equations, we had the Dirac-Ramond equations yesterday, and apply them to these two states. And then show from these decompositions that these are equivalent to the following equations on these antisymmetric n forms. Okay, so let's just use the Dirac-Ramond operator that we wrote down yesterday. Okay, so in exercise 2B now, these are our physical constraints. So the Dirac-Ramond equation gives us the mass shell condition. It gives us the physical constraints on the states. And those should look familiar. Those look very familiar to the equations of motion, the Maxwell equations, and Bianchi identity that you would usually write down in four-dimensional electrodynamics for the field strength tensor. Now we're writing them down for an n form, but that's what we think of them. They're like the Maxwell equation of motion and a Bianchi identity, but now for an antisymmetric tensor field strength. The two equations together tell us that F can be written as the derivative of some potential. So F can be derived now from some potential. And the terminology we're going to use is that the Fs, the actual field strengths, we're going to call the Ramond-Ramond fields. Okay? They're the degrees of freedom in the Ramond-Ramond sector. The potentials that they're derived from will be called the Ramond-Ramond potentials.
But in general case theory, the potential is more fundamental when we say the field.
I could have done this, I mentioned I could have done this another way. I could have started by imposing physical constraints and then going through this group theory analysis, then what would have naturally come out of that actually would be the C's, the potentials themselves, because you would have reduced from looking at things in SO91 to things in SO8. So So the natural objects which would have come out of that would have been the seas. This way, it's this. The reason I presented it this way is I find this is a nice shortcut to see that these Fs that you get here are really the field strengths and not potentials. So this is, I want to make this distinction. Okay, but I could have found the seas in a more fundamental way. Okay, now you have this duality now, and if I use this analogy with electrodynamics further, I can think of this Hodge duality over here as an electric-magnetic duality. And on the Ramond-Ramond potentials, this identifies the potential Cn with C8 minus n. You can just check that from these definitions. Okay, so what type of potentials now do we have in the 2A and 2B theories? Well, you come over here again, you look at, you're summing on the 2A case, you're summing over n even, so these are even rank tensors, so that means that the C's over here must be of odd rank. So these are the potentials we have. It runs all the way as close to 10 as you can get. Pardon me? A C minus 1.
C9.
A C9. I haven't put it in because it's non-dynamical. Because the field strength would then be a rank 10 field strength. So it would be just proportional to the volume form in 10 dimensions. So I haven't put it in. Well, yeah, the sum over all n means to go up as far as you can, but I haven't put it in here for that reason. Okay? So we have odd rank potentials here, and I just mentioned that by this electric magnetic duality, C5 and C7 are dual to C3 and C1 respectively. In the 2B case, conversely, here we had a sum over n odd, so over here we have only even rank C's. Okay? So because of the self-duality condition of the 5 representation, C4 is self-dual. And C6 and C8 are dual to C2 and C0. Okay? So those are Ramond-Ramond fields and Ramond-Ramond potentials. And now I'm going to discuss what is meant by Ramond-Ramond charge. What is Ramond-Ramond charge? So, well, recall what we did in lecture 2. We had this new field, this NSNSB field. And I showed you that it coupled directly to the string world sheet. That is that the string, the fundamental string, was a source for the anti-symmetric B field. Okay? And the real way I showed you that is I showed you that when you write down the vertex operator for this, the vertex operator couples B to the string world sheet. Now, if you go and start writing down vertex operators for the Ramond-Ramond sector, what you find is that it's these fields that I've derived. The fields that I came up with here are the things that you construct your vertex operators from. So they're the things that live on the string world sheet. They're the things that couple to the fundamental string. So these potentials should somehow be the more fundamental objects, though. Not the field strings, the potentials should be. So these potentials do not couple to the string or appear in the corresponding vertex operators. So that's important because it means we have these potentials floating around, but perturbative string states don't couple to them. So perturbative string states don't couple to them, so that means there must be some non-perturbative objects around which couple to them. We'd like to find some non-perturbative objects which couple to them. What type of things can these be? Well, so CP plus 1 is a P plus 1 form. So the type of thing, so we had, when we did had the B field, this was a 2 form, it coupled to the string world sheet. Coupled to an object which was extended in one spatial dimension. By a similar vein, these P plus 1 forms must couple to an object which has P spatial extensions. So we call these p-brains, they sweep out what's called a world volume as they move in time. So there's some hypersurface that are described by them. And that's what these things must couple to, just by dimension counting. So what we can do is we will say that if we do find these p-brains, these p-dimensional degrees of freedom, then we can couple them to these potentials by writing down a minimal coupling. Just like I did for the B field, just like you do for an electromagnetic vector potential, we write down a coupling like this. So this is the induced world volume element from the embedding of this world volume into space-time. X's, again, are just embedding functions now that take the world volume into space-time. And the C's couple in this fashion. And then there's some number there, which we'll call the charge Q. Okay, so just a standard minimal coupling. By minimal coupling, I mean that this is invariant under gauge transformations. These P plus 1 form gauge transformations of the Raman-Raman potentials. And as usual, as you would argue in electrodynamics, these will leave the quantum theory invariant if I demand that the p-brain wave function transforms under a gauge transformation in this fashion. And this can be used in electrodynamics as a definition of charge, of electric charge. And this is exactly what I'm going to do here. I'm going to refer to this as the charge of this object. And that object is going to be called the Raman-Raman charge. So this is the definition of Raman-Raman charge. So the upshot is that string theory should be complemented with non-perturbative states which carry these Raman-Raman charges. And these non-perturbative states turn out to be D-brains, Dirichlet brains. Yeah?
So you said if you make vertex operators out of these Raman-Raman
fields.
These end up coupling, the field strength would end up coupling to the string velocity.
Yeah, you construct the vertex operators like I showed you on Wednesday. Okay, do that construction, and the things that you use to do that are the Fs, because of the way that I built up the Raman-Raman sector.
So these Cs are what end up coupling to D brains.
Well, that's not obvious that they should do that, but this is what I'm pushing through.
Is there something that couples to the strings? Is the field strengths coupled to the strings?
But they do couple to the strings, yes. Okay. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. When you write down a vertex operator, remember how I showed you to write down a vertex operator? You use this prescription and you're integrating over the string world sheet. Okay, so any perturbative string state is written in terms of a vertex operator that I integrate over the string world sheet. So my point is that the Cs don't do that. Okay, so there must be non-perturbative objects floating around. Okay, so this is some circumstantial evidence for D-brains. It's really a preview of a long line of development. Now what I want to do is I want to give you another piece of evidence for the existence of D-brains. We'll look at T-duality. So one of the main motivations for doing this is to give some systematic demonstration that there are D-brains floating around in string theory. But we'll do that when we come to the open strings, really. So we're going to just look at T-duality for closed strings first, because it's an interesting phenomenon in its own right. And T-duality represents a very, very powerful tool in string theory. So let's do that. So what is T-duality? So let's start with what we did in lecture 1. We go and write down the closed bosonic string mode expansions. I'm just going to look at the bosonic string for a while now. I'll come back to superstrings at the end of the lecture. So the closed string mode expansions. I had left moving modes, I had right moving modes, and I took their sum to write down the total string embedding field. And that looked as follows. There was a zero mode. I write it as two zero modes now, and you'll see why in a moment. There were these zero mode oscillators here, another combination of zero modes, and then all the higher vibrational modes of the string. And I'm not going to write those down because they're not going to play any role in this discussion. So what do we do now? We say, okay, we want these embedding functions to be single valued as I go once around the loop of the closed string. So remember, the closed string is a world sheet is an infinite cylinder. If I go once around the loop of that cylinder, I should get back the same function. If you do the calculation from here, you find that x mu actually changes by some amount. So demanding that these functions be periodic requires that this term vanish, and then along with this formula for the total center of mass momentum of the string, you find that these alpha naughts are fixed in this way. Okay, so the total momentum you get by taking a tau derivative and integrating over the string world sheet. So that requires this, and this is of course what we did. I didn't do it in so much detail in lecture one, but that's implicitly how we arrived at the closed string mode expansions. Okay, so that's just what we saw in lecture one. Now all of this is true if all of the directions of your space-time have infinite extent. There are no compact directions. What we want to do now is look at how this argument is modified in the case where one of the spatial directions is curled up on a circle. So we want to compactify one of the directions on a circle. So for definiteness, we'll take the last spatial coordinate of our 10-dimensional space-time, x9, and we'll put it on a circle of radius r. What does this mean? This means that x9 should be identified with x9 plus 2 pi r. Okay, you go once around the perimeter of this circle of radius r, you get back to the same point. So because of this periodicity constraint, you want to demand that wave functions, or a basis for the expansion of wave functions in that direction, is single valued. You want these objects to be single valued. And this object will be single valued under this identification only if the momentum in the ninth direction is quantized. Quantized is some integer multiple of the inverse radius. This has nothing to do with strings, this quantization. This quantization condition happens for any quantum system that you would put on a circle. Okay? This is nothing unique to strings. Okay, now P09 still has a formula like this. Okay, so this gives us an equation for these zero mode oscillators, our first equation. Now, because these are strings, something new does happen. Something new does happen because a string is an extended object, so it can also wind around this circle. The string can wrap around this compact circle. And the number of times that it does that is called its winding number. It can do that an integer number of times. And it can do it an integer number of times in an opposite direction. So W is any positive or negative integer. So it means that as we go once around the string, we're allowed to wrap W times around the target space circle. We're allowed to do that because x9 lives on a circle, so this is the same coordinate. The thing on the right is identified with the thing on the left. So your notion of periodicity, of course, changes now. This is allowed to be a multivalued function now. So how do we do this? What we do is we take the mode expansion, we add a term to it. We add a term which is given by this, wr sigma. We're certainly allowed to do that because this, adding that term to this mode expansion will still solve the two-dimensional wave equation. So So we do that, we add it there, and then if we put that term in there, you see that this relation is indeed satisfied. But now remember what the sigma term looked like. The sigma term had this combination alpha minus alpha tilde. So this means now that alpha minus alpha tilde in the 9 direction is given by this formula in terms of the winding number. So that's a second equation now for these zero-mode oscillators. So you have the two equations, go and solve them simultaneously, and you get these formulas for the alpha naughts. Okay? The PLs that are sitting here, PL and PR, are called the left and right moving momenta. And they're quantized now. They're quantized. The first term in their quantization laws just gives you the usual Kaluza-Klein momentum that you would get in any system from the fact that you've put the theory on a circle. The second term is a stringy effect. It gives you the winding number, the number of times that your given string state is wrapping around this target space circle. So we can go and look at the mass spectrum now. When we look at the mass spectrum in the remaining 1 plus 8 uncompactified directions, so we write down the product of momenta like this, but we only sum mu from 0 up to 8 rather than 0 up to 9. Just use the exact same arguments we did before in lecture 2. We get this type of relation here. Looking at the constraint L naught equals 1. That's in the for the left movers. For the right movers, you look at the constraint L naught tilde equals 1, you get this formula. So N and N tilde are, again, the level numbers. They're the contributions from the infinitely many oscillators that we have. Okay. So that's the mass spectrum. Now, again, you notice that there are some differences here. If we take the sum and difference of the left and right moving constraints, remember what happened. The sum of the constraints gives us the Hamiltonian, and the difference between the two gave us a level matching condition, right? When we had the two left and right moving conditions, we summed them to get the Hamiltonian, and we subtracted them to get a level matching condition. But it turns out that they're now modified. They're modified exactly by terms that come from this tower of Kaluza-Klein momenta and the tower of winding states. So the mass shell formula looks like this. Remember, before we just had this term. We only had this term. Now we get these extra contributions from the Kaluza-Klein momenta, the winding modes, and now even my level matching condition is modified. I no longer have the condition that n is equal to n tilde, like I did before. I have an extra contribution here. When n and w are both zero, of course, I get back the original formulae that I had. And I just stress again that the winding modes are a purely stringy phenomenon here. So let's look at this mass formula and two limits. Let's look at that formula in the limit first, where r goes to infinity. So I decompactify the ninth direction. Let it have infinite extent again. What happens in this formula? Well, if W is non-zero, then these terms, of course, go to infinity. They become infinitely massive, and they just decouple from the rest of the spectrum. This term, as R goes to infinity, we formally can keep this finite by letting n go to infinity. In other words, let n become some continuum variable. Then this piece here just goes into the usual momentum squared, the usual continuous momentum squared. So in the limit r going to infinity, all the winding states disappear because they're energetically unfavorable. So I should just put w equal to 0 right from the beginning. And the other piece goes over to the usual continuum zero modes, as we expect. This is what would happen. This is exactly what would happen if you decompactified a direction in quantum field theory. The Kaluza-Klein momenta would go to the usual continuum momenta. What's interesting now is if you look at the other limit, the limit r going to zero, so you shrink the circle to a point. What happens then? Well, by the same argument, this term blows up, so all of the n non-zero modes decouple from the spectrum. They become infinitely massive, and we should just look at n equals zero. However, the winding states, as r goes to zero, I can keep this term finite by taking w to infinity. So I let w go to infinity now, let that be this combination become a continuum variable, and I've found some kind of strange thing happening here. Because this, as r goes to zero, I've arrived at formally the same situation that I had in the r going to infinity case. R going to infinity case, I had an infinite dimension appearing. But now I've shrunk the circle down. I've apparently gotten rid of that dimension. But this argument, because of the winding modes, shows that some extra uncompactified direction has appeared. That's not what would happen in quantum field theory. In quantum field theory, the fields which would survive this limit would just be independent of this direction that you've blown down to a point. They would be completely independent of that. But here, that's not the case. So how do we resolve this fact? Where does this extra dimension come from? Well, this is where T-duality comes into play. You look at the mass formula we have, and you observe that it has a symmetry. The symmetry under interchanging Kaluza-Klein momenta and winding numbers, and also redefining the radius of the circle that the theory is compactified on. So r goes to 1 over r, and then some constant to get the dimensions right. This is called a T-duality symmetry. Now, it's formally obtained by doing a parity transformation on the right-moving zero-mode oscillators. If you just change the sign of alpha naught tilde in the ninth direction, that's the same thing as just doing these transformations up here. If you go and redo the calculation, you'll find that that's exactly what this corresponds to. Just look at the definition of alpha tilde. So the terminology we use, there's some new circle here. This is where the new dimension came from. The terminology we use is that the string theory compactified on the circle of this new radius is called the T-dual string theory. And the process of going from the theory to its dual is known as T-dualization. So we've realized a T-duality at the level of the zero modes. But we can also realize it at the level of the full mode expansion of the fields. We just define a space-time parity transformation of the right movers. So the left movers don't change, the right movers change by a sign. We're allowed to do that. We can do that. We can change the sign of all the higher vibrational modes. There's no problem with that. So this is now what we call our T-duality transformation. It's a parity transformation that acts only on the right-moving modes. Okay, so when we do that, what does this mean? When we do this transformation, we go and look at the total string embedding function before we took the sum of left movers and right movers. Now what we do is we take the difference of left and right movers. So I call these now my dual string coordinates. You're certainly allowed to take the difference. There's no reason to have to take the sum of the two left movers and right movers. The sum or difference will satisfy the two-dimensional wave equation. So we do that, we get these dual coordinates, and then the zero mode spectrum of this guy now is that of the T-dual theory. And from this, you conclude that T-duality, this transformation, is an exact symmetry of perturbative string theory. Because you can rewrite all your amplitudes using this transformation and find that this is just a symmetry. So this explains this apparent paradox of where this extra dimension came from. So what are the consequences of this? Well, there are several consequences of it, but I want to just briefly mention what the consequences of what you can think of as string geometry. What is the geometry of space-time seen by strings? Well, if you look at naively or classically, you would think that the space, what I call the moduli space of string theories, which are compactified on a circle, is parametrized by their radius, the radius of the circle that you've put them on. And classically, any radius would be allowed. Any positive number would be allowed. However, because of T-duality, radii which lie below the string length are never seen. That's because the relevant radii, the lower bound on the radius, comes from looking at the fixed point of this transformation. The fixed point of this transformation, you find, is exactly at the string length, the square root of alpha prime, the intrinsic string length. So the circles that are seen by string theory are always larger than the intrinsic size of your strings. And that's because if I have a string that's defined on a circle of radius less than LS, by T-duality, I can take that theory and map it over to something on a circle of radius larger than LS. Okay? So closed strings never see this thing, and that's just because closed strings on their own cannot probe distances smaller than their intrinsic length. Okay? So strings see space-time geometry much differently than ordinary point particles do. And this is a heuristic picture of how string theory modifies general relativity, or just space-time geometry, at very short distance scales.
But you can also say string can also be very large.
Sure you can. Well.
But you have a preference here. You say you can't see small.
Well, I can't see small because it's got a size. Uh-huh. So it can't...
But by this duality, you can say you cannot see the big one. The big one can deal with the small.
Yeah, that doesn't feel right, though. Okay. That's the closed string case. Let's go and look at the open string case. The open string case is much different. It's much different because an open string is not going to wind around this compact dimension. So they don't have a quantum number like W. They don't have a winding mode. So if you let R go to zero, in the case of an open string, the situation will resemble very much that of ordinary field theory. Namely, that as far as the open strings are concerned, that dimension will just disappear. So in the small radius limit, the open strings will effectively live in 9 space-time dimensions. However, this raises another paradox. It raises another paradox because there is another duality which I haven't told you about. It's a world sheet duality, which demands that both open and closed strings be present in your system. You cannot have open strings without closed strings. There's an open-closed string duality, so both open and closed strings are there from the onset. Now, in the small radius limit, the open strings, I've just told you, live in 9 dimensions. But the closed strings live in 10 space-time dimensions. They don't see the shrinking of this radius. So how can that be? How can the open strings only see 9 dimensions while the closed strings see 10 dimensions? So the resolution is that if you look at the interior of an open string, you don't care about its boundaries, then that essentially looks like a closed string. You're in the interior of the thing, you're far away from the boundaries, it looks just like a closed string. So the interior of your open string is still moving in 10 dimensions. It still vibrates, oscillates in 10 dimensions. What's different now are the endpoints. The endpoints are the distinguished objects of the open string. And they're the things that are constrained to move in only 9 dimensions. If I take the 2 endpoints and I'm saying I'm constraining them to move in 9 dimensions, that means I'm fixing them on a hyperplane. I'm fixing them in some subspace of my space-time. So again, in this limit, these open strings are fixed to lie on a nine-dimensional hyperplane in the full 10-dimensional space-time of the closed strings. So let's make that more quantitative now. Let's make that a bit more quantitative. Let's go and write down now the open string mode expansions. So the open string mode expansions we got from the closed ones by the doubling trick that I explained on Tuesday. And they look like this. This is what we wrote down for the open string mode expansions. Again, I put in a little extra degree of freedom on the zero modes, which will become just to make the formulas look nice at the end. Alpha knots look like this in terms of the center of mass momenta. And now I define the total string embedding field again by summing these two contributions, and I get this formula. Again, exactly what we did on Tuesday. That's exactly the thing I did when I talked about the open string on Tuesday. So now, again, let's compactify the ninth direction. We put it on a circle of radius r. Again, the momentum is quantized, okay? That applies to any system. The momentum is quantized, and we still have these Kaluza-Klein momentum modes. Okay, we put it on a circle. So now, how do we define T-duality? Well, we just used the rule that we wrote down in the closed string case. We defined T-duality to be this parity transformation on the right movers. So these terms, which came from the left movers, stay untouched, but these ones should flip sign. So in other words, instead of adding the two contributions here, we should subtract them. That's what T-duality tells us to do. So the new dual coordinate is the difference now of these two contributions, and it looks like this. It looks different. In fact, note that over here, we had a term that was linear in tau. And this is what told us that the momentum of the string was this P-naught sitting here. Over here, we don't have that term. We don't have a tau term. So the momentum of this coordinate is zero. This coordinate does not move. Okay? You can indeed just check that the endpoints of this coordinate do not move. They're fixed somewhere. They carry no momentum. It's fixed somewhere in the x9 direction. And what this means is that, remember before, when we wrote down this expansion automatically satisfied the Neumann boundary conditions, which told us that d sigma x was equal to 0. Okay? And a d sigma for the geometry of the string worldsheet that I have, d sigma is the derivative which is normal to the boundary of the string worldsheet. Instead of those now, what we do when we do this rewriting is we change the Neumann boundary conditions to Dirichlet boundary conditions. These are Dirichlet boundary conditions now. They tell you that the tau derivative vanishes. Or in terms of the geometry of the string worldsheet that I have, this is a tangential derivative to the string boundary. And you can, just using this formula up here, you can conclude that indeed the open string endpoints are at a fixed place in space-time. You take the difference of the two endpoints, and you find that they agree up to the periodicity of the T-dual direction. So this is like going n times around the circumference of the T-dual circle. So those two coordinates are fixed on some hyperplanes, and the hyperplanes are periodically identified. Okay? I could think of this, take this as the definition of an open string with a given winding number n. Winding meaning that it starts on some hyperplane and it ends up on another hyperplane, but the hyperplanes are periodically identified with respect to the T-dual circle. So here are these hyperplanes now the string is attached to. Now this applies only, of course, to the ninth direction. I haven't done, all my other directions are still uncompactified. And indeed, in those directions, the open string endpoints do carry momentum. They have Neumann boundary conditions, and they are free to move in these other undualized directions. There are 1 plus 8 of them, 8 spatial directions. And that hyperplane, that subspace of your spacetime, is called a D-brane. Or more precisely, because it has 8 spatial extensions, it's called a D8 brane. You could generalize this construction. So I only compactified one of the directions on a circle, but you can compactify any number of them, say M directions, and go through the same argument. Each direction will carry Dirichlet boundary conditions, and now these strings will be attached to a hyperplane that has 9 minus M spatial extensions. If we call that number P, then this is what we call a DP brane. So what's the conclusion? The conclusion is that T-duality, as a symmetry of the full string theory, the theory that contains both open and closed strings, necessitates D-brains. Now, we're not going to go on with D-brains because there are no more lectures, but the way I presented the D-brains, they look like static objects which are just sitting there in your space-time. It turns out that's not the case. The D-brains aren't static objects. They're things which can fluctuate and which can move. They can fluctuate, and the way that they fluctuate is from the dynamics that's induced by the open strings which attach to them. So remember, the endpoints of the open string carry degrees of freedom, such as a photon field. And the dynamics of those fields are what describe the dynamics of these D-brains. So that's sort of where one would go with all of this next. So an exercise is just a simple exercise on T-duality, is just to show that the T-duality definition interchanges the definition of these normal and tangential derivatives, and thus it really does swap the Dirichlet and Neumann boundary conditions. So the last thing, my last transparency, is just to tell you what T-duality does to the type 2 superstring. Just to complete the picture. So what did T-duality do for the bosonic string? It flipped the right moving modes. Flipped the sign of the right movers. So now we put the fermions in and we want to demand that the theory have world sheet supersymmetry. We want to demand that the dual theory likewise have world sheet supersymmetry. So in order to do that, I must also flip the sign of the corresponding right-moving fermion. So T-duality acts on the fermions by flipping the sign of the right movers, just like they do for the bosons. Now, if we look at the Raman sector, what happens? Remember, the Raman sector was the sector where the fermions had a zero mode. The zero mode was essentially a gamma matrix, a Dirac matrix. So it acts like this. It flips the sign of the zero mode as well, and hence it flips the sign of gamma 9. It flips the sign of gamma 9 only, though. So that means only gamma 9 flips its sign in the formula for gamma 11, the product of all 10 gamma matrices. So gamma 11 also flips sign. So T-duality flips the sign of gamma 11. And so we have the two possible GSO projections, P plus or minus, which had a plus or minus sign in front of gamma 11. And what you see now is that T-duality reverses the GSO projection on the right movers. Okay? So the effect of T-duality is to give the opposite GSO projection on the right moving fields. In other words, I look from the way I've defined the type 2A and type 2B superstrings, T-duality interchanges the type 2A and type 2B theories. So it takes you from 2A to 2B and vice versa. If I repeat, this same conclusion is reached if I t-dualize any odd number of directions. I'll send 2a to 2b and vice versa. Whereas if I t-dualize an even number of directions, the 2a theory goes to 2a, it's invariant, and 2b goes to 2b is also invariant. And this, of course, now if you think back to the Riemann-Riemann potentials, t-duality automatically must do something to the Riemann-Riemann potentials, right? Because the 2a and 2b theories had different types of R potentials. So t-duality also induces some mapping from a given set of Riemann-Riemann potentials to another set. And that has an effect on the types of D-brains, as one could argue. But that's it. Thanks.
T stands for what?
T? There's an old version of this, right, from the Ising model, right? Where they also called it T.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what we say. It's toroidal or target space, but I'm just saying there's a much older version of this type of duality where it was also called T. So it's a historical thing.
From the fundamental string and one brain, how do I know which is which?
Well, one of them carries Riemann-Riemann charge; the other doesn't.
You mean that? The B field cannot be coupled to
the B field couples to the fundamental string.
Yeah, but not to the one.
Right. The D string couples to the corresponding Riemann-Riemann potential.
So in the bosonic string, we still have D brain.
Yeah,
but
unstable.
Because we don't have Riemann-Riemann charge.
Well, they're unstable. I mean, just like bosonic. You see, in the bosonic theory, you do have the D brains there, and open strings are attaching to the D brains, but the open strings will have a tachyonic mode. Yeah. I think Ashok Sen will discuss this in his.
Also vanish, like, I mean, the super version of the D brain, they are source.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're just these things where open strings are attaching. I mean, they're there because the open strings are there. But everything's unstable, of course. So these are unstable D brains. Which
this fundamental open string cannot be attached to a fundamental closed string. When
those are same. A fundamental open string attached to a fundamental closed string.
I mean, geometrically, there's no reason to prevent.
But that, well, that's like a. Some kind of intersection. I mean, in a world sheet picture, it's you want your intersecting two surfaces. I mean,
I don't know.
I understand what you're trying to picture. I'm trying to say it's the wrong picture you have, because you don't have a world sheet and then you draw a string. I mean, it's you look at things from the point of view of world sheets. So what you're saying is like you slice two world sheets together. No, it can, but I don't think that's what you quite meant.
Like a classical picture, you have closed string moving around, open string around. Maybe there was an accident that bumped. So, how can we prevent this accident?
Well, they're interaction. I think you're trying to think of interactions,
you
but
push away, you say no.
Well, they do. I mean, they interact, but it's in a smooth way. And this is what I stressed in the second lecture, that there aren't these singularities that you're thinking of. I mean, the string diagrams are smooth.
There's a part of the principle?
Yeah, they just are. Just when I write the path integral, I sum over all Riemann surfaces, all smooth objects.
So now we have string and also brain also can move around. Presumably slowly, I don't know. Maybe the whole picture, classic picture,
come on. Well, there's stuff moving around, and the D-brains, so I mean the picture you should have of D-brains looks like this, where there are open strings which start and end on them, but these D-brains can also, they also interact with each other.
Sort of the open string pulls this D-brain along.
Well, it doesn't pull it along, no. Well, the point is these D-brains actually have gravitational interaction. So they, one D-brain can spit out a closed string and the other one can absorb it. So these D-brains actually interact through closed string states. Yes?
Can you carry out similar discussions if you don't compare the fact to Taurus, but some sort of Kolodion manifold?
Well, it's not T-duality.
Is there anything there?
You can do this. So there are versions of T-duality for compactifications which have a certain number of isometries. So if you have some directions which have an isometry, what this means, at least locally, is that in the direction of that isometry, you can think of it as a circle. So there are versions of the T-duality rules for more general type compactifications.
And is there any indication to open strings? Similar indications?
Similar to the ones that I've drawn. I'm sure there are. I haven't thought about it. But I'm sure there are. I'm sure you reached the same type of conclusion. I haven't talked about any curved backgrounds here, but certainly you can put putting D-brains in a curved background puts more constraints on what you can have. And in my flat case, it's very simple, but when you start making the manifold more complicated, there are more conditions that actually define a stable D-brain as a supersymmetric object in this.
Do you have something like a low energy effective action which contains D-brain?
Sure, you've got, yeah, there's a supergravity action that you write down for all of the gravitational fields, and then there are terms you put on that involve the Raman-Raman fields and Raman-Raman potentials. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there any cosmology evidence supporting the existence of D-brains?
I'm not the person to ask that. You should ask Robert Brandenburger that.
Okay. So, can you comment on the higher mode theory? Do they cover new object or can you say that they cover to D-brain or basically
the form for higher mode? You want to know what the massive string states do in all of this? They're there, but we usually look at this in a low energy limit. I mean, when we talk about gauge theories on a D-brain, we look at the massless states on it.
I'm asking whether we know all the objects in the field.
I don't know.